The Holy Gospel of Christ according to John. Jesus came to a Samaritan city called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" Jews do not share things in common with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and what it is that I am saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us the well and with his sons and his flocks drank from it?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come back." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had 5 husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us." Jesus said to her, "I am he, the one who is speaking to you." Just then, his disciples came. They were astonished that he was speaking with a woman, but no one said, "What do you want?" or "Why are you speaking with her?" Then the woman left her water jar and went back to the city. She said to the people, "Come and see a man who told me everything I have ever done. He cannot be the Messiah, can he?" They left the city and were on their way to him. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, "Rabbi, eat something." But he said to them, "I have food to eat that you do not know about." So the disciples said to one another, "Surely no one has brought him something to eat." Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to complete his work. Do you not say, 4 months more, then comes the harvest? But I tell you, look around you and see how the fields are ripe for harvesting. The reaper is already receiving wages and is gathering food for fruit for eternal life, so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true. One sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor. Many Samaritans from that city believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I have ever done. So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. They said to the woman, "It is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this is truly the Savior of the world." The Gospel of our Lord.
That's a long piece out of John's Gospel, isn't it? Yeah, in years past, we've decided, in fact, Betty reminded me this morning, she said, "You want me to do the short version?" It's like, nah, let's hear the whole thing this year. So we heard from the book of Exodus, great intro, Veronica. You could entitle this entire section of Exodus, "The Grumblings," right? And then as it goes on, "The Brilliant Read Dumb Ideas." Good reading, thank you. And then the Psalm 95, I have to tell you, every time we do Psalm 95, I kick right into my muscle memory of 6 years of leading chapel with the day school, the kids of St. Paul's in Ventura, California, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year. We would gather every morning, and we would sing what's called the Vanity. "Come, let us sing to the Lord." So that tune just starts running in my head as soon as we start doing 95. Would you like me to inflict it on you? Nah. We'll skip it today. And then we come to this, again, this very long and really packed story in the Gospel according to John that describes this conversation between Jesus and this Samaritan woman. And in order to understand, to even begin to get what's going on here and how potent and powerful this story is, we've got to understand the history of the enmity between the ancient Jews and the ancient Samaritans. Does anybody know anything about why they've been fighting, and still to this day, fighting, all these centuries? Where does it come from? Anybody know? Pardon me? Well, Palestine, yeah. The Samaritans would now be referred to as Palestinians in the north, with the Jewish or Israeli in the south. Land war? Funny you should mention, Sandy. Big surprise here. So, in the year 721 before the Common Era, so we're talking 700 years prior to the first century during the time of Jesus, the Assyrians come along, as did others. I mean, the Babylonians were first, and then somebody else, and then the Assyrians, and then somebody after them, and eventually Rome, and conquers this real estate known from ancient times as the Palestine, the whole eastern edge of the Mediterranean. And I know we've talked about the Roman Empire inventing the approach of divide and conquer, but it's not entirely true, because Assyria and some of these other ancient powers who overran this turf used a similar strategy. Best way to hang on to a piece of real estate once you've conquered it is to divide those people that are living on it and get them fighting amongst themselves and keep them fighting. And as long as they're fighting, they're not paying as much attention to how we are using them, draining their resources, oppressing them, all that good stuff. So that's what's been happening since 721 before the Common Era. Then, layer onto that, around the year 200 before the Common Era, the folks in the north who by now are referred to as the people of Samaria or Samaritans, now Palestinians and Syrians, decide, because they're divided and conquered, it's working out, and now under the boot heel of Imperial Rome, the folks in the north decide, you know, we can't get to Jerusalem, it's just not working out in terms of travel, so we're going to set up our own cultic center and our own temple here in the north in an area known as Gerizim. And lo and behold, they do that, and no sooner do they do that that the folks in the south say, hey, you can't do that. The cultic center and the temple are in Jerusalem. And guess what? It's on. So between the land wars that Sandy mentioned and the whole divide and conquer approach to life and the lovely ways we carry our religious traditions and use them as weapons against each other, the enmity between Samaritans and the ancient Jewish people is locked in nice and solid, to the point where it was not allowed by the first century of the Common Era for a Jewish person to interact in any way, shape, or form with somebody from the area of Samaria, a Samaritan. It was not allowed. Verboten. And here, Jesus, here's a couple of astonishing things. One, he's actually in Samaria, so he's already in enemy territory. Gospel of John has him coming and going around there on a pretty regular basis, and you got to wonder, why is he hanging out in that area? Good question. Another sermon. So he's in Samaria. He's tired. They've been traveling around, so he plops himself at this well, and he engages this Samaritan woman. Now, there is also a law in the first century of the Common Era that a Jewish man cannot it's even worse than talking to just any old Samaritan, but a Jewish man cannot, under any circumstances, engage a Samaritan woman, or any woman in public for that matter. This is just not good at all. The police are going to come and, you know, do bad things. And here he is. He engages this Samaritan woman and says, give me a drink. And later on in the story, she says to Jesus, give me this living water of which you speak. And it's on those two requests that this entire story hangs. Now, most of us, maybe all of us, have been told that the Samaritan woman is a sinner. Yes? Because she's been married so many times. And then, of course, I know, you got to wonder about the woman. I mean, five, really? I mean, didn't you get it by three? I know. Pardon me? Yes. Yeah, it's really, what's really going on here is what's called levirate marriage, that if one husband bails or dies, a brother has to step up and marry her, and then another, and another, and another, and another. I mean, it's part of this ancient patriarchal system that in lots of ways we have continued in different ways. We've just gotten more subtle about it these days. You know, and women were considered property and all that. That's what's really going on. It turns out that we were told that she's a sinner is a lie. It has nothing to do with what's going on in this story. And Jesus certainly doesn't interact with her as though she's a sinner. He engages her. They're in a conversation. I want you to hold that thought, okay? So forget all that sin and sinner stuff, because that takes us down a rabbit hole that is not helpful to us at all, okay? And it's not even true to the story. So go ahead and let that go. In effect, what happens here around their requests, give me a drink, says Jesus, and the Samaritan lady says, give me this living water of which you speak. And then as the conversation progresses, she points out to Jesus, you know, you have no bucket. I can relate to that in all kinds of ways, seriously. And in turn, Jesus says to her, you have no husband. So in effect, what has happened almost instantaneously, I mean, and perhaps you've had an experience like this where you meet someone for the first time and there just seems to be a connection. In effect, what's happening here is she says, hey, Jewish boy with no bucket. To which she responds, or to which Jesus responds, hey, Samaritan lady with no husband. Do you see where this is going? I mean, what's really happening here is they are connecting, and they're treating each other right off the bat like old friends who can poke at each other. I mean, it's a stop. And so by the time Jesus' friends, you know, the disciples, come along, and the story tells us they're astonished, the Greek translation of that word is they're stunned, okay? It's like two buddies hanging out at the well, poking at each other, making fun of one another. And they're going, what in God's name is going on? Now, so far in the Gospel according to John, Jesus has had all kinds of conversations with all kinds of people, including his followers, and all of them, without exception, are talking and out of their heads. They're trying to figure out who he is, what he's doing, and what he wants from them. It's all in the head. Go back to the story of Nicodemus. Nicodemus is talking to Jesus out of his head. And here, for the first time, in the fourth chapter of John's Gospel, there's two people talking not just head to head, but heart to heart. This is important. And, again, with that sinner spin that people have put on this story and then completely lost its deeper meaning and power for us. Just like we've done with the story of Adam and Eve that we heard a couple of weeks ago, where, oh yeah, the story of the fall. Oh, it's the story of original sin. Oh, the snake made me do it. Oh, the woman made me do it. Oh, the... Whoops. And it completely misses the point and the power of that story, because that story of Adam and Eve is really the story of original love, original equilibrium, and original grace, right? We talked about that. Same thing with this story. Drop the old, drop the head stuff. Stop trying to figure out who she is, and notice that they have engaged each other like old friends. A Jewish guy. Hey, Jewish boy with no bucket. Hey, Samaritan lady with no husband. And something amazing happens. We'll get back to that in a second. So, these last 3 days, I'm at Camp Galilee with members of what is known in Nevada as The Cool. This is the bishop's designation for the Commission on Ordination and Licensing, formerly known as the Commission on Ministry. And we're hunkered down at Galilee. One of our own, Louise Hogan, is also has been appointed as a member of the COOL. And our job, and I'm on it, I've been trying to get off the COOL for years, years. I was the chair of it for years. Finally, the bishop let me go, and then 6 months later, when he asked me to be a dean, said, oh, by the way, the deans are members of the COOL. I've been doing this for 20-some years. It's like the diocese ought to be embarrassed, but they're not. So we're hunkered down, and our job is to enter into conversation and relationship and read tons of paperwork from people who have entered a process of discernment around the possibility of ordination, either as deacons or priests, or in some cases, discernment around being a lay Eucharistic visitor. We issue those licenses, lay preachers, worship leaders, etc. The heavy lifting, the heavy labor is around those discerning vocations, ordained vocations as either deacons and priests. And we had 8 people this year, had to read a stack of paper about 3.5, maybe 4 inches tall. Spent 3 days, the first day on Thursday, reading through, talking amongst ourselves, trying to wrap our brains around who these folks are, what they're about, and then all day Friday, all the aspirants come to Galilee from the north and the south and the hinterlands, the rurals, and we gather with them, we do this whole process, we worship together, we pray together, we hang out over coffee together and find out things about each other, and then spent the rest of the day, literally the rest of the day, well into the evening, interviewing these folks in small teams and listening as carefully as we can in order the next day on Saturday to gather again as the COOL. We kick all the aspirants out, go home, get out of here, and we spend the entire day on Saturday going, okay, where might God be leading these folks? And the COOL is the group that green lights them for the bishop. In other words, the COOL recommends folks to move on in their process. So it's wonderful work. I mean, we meet some amazing people, but it's grueling, it's humbling, and at times unnerving, because we're messing with people's lives and their futures here. It's heavy. So we come back just both enervated and exhausted. And at one point, over the course of that 3 days, I'm having a conversation with one of the aspirants. We'll call him Jim. He's from a parish in the south, in the Las Vegas area. He's in his early 70s, and he has been forced into retirement by his airline company because of his eyes and his age, and he is now, he's a pilot, but can no longer fly because of his eyes, and so he's now training people in simulators, teaching them how to fly. And Jim was identified, I think he was identified in the congregation as a potential deacon for the church. And Jim's got some serious question about that, but he's willing to go with the flow, so he shows up, and he and I are talking, and it turns out that Jim, wonderful guy, he's one of these real Americans. I mean, sort of arch-conservative, America, love it or leave it, make America great again kind of guys. And he was invited by the rector of his parish to begin attending meetings of what's known in the South as Nevadans for the Common Good. And they are an organizing arm of churches down there that we're looking to bring to the North, because years ago when we wanted to get involved with this stuff up here in the North with that thing called Action, and then that whole thing went belly up. I mean, it just got weird, and then it got weirder, and we said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. Be fabulous to have these folks come into the area. There's Jim showing up for these meetings, really kind of wondering about this. And wouldn't you know it, one of the issues that Nevadans for the Common Good has picked up is the whole question of immigration, our favorite subject today. So Jim comes waltzing into these meetings going, right. And he begins to engage and enters into conversation with this little Mexican lady who has lived in the United States for 25 years. She and her husband have remained undocumented for all kinds of odd and interesting reasons. Their kids have been born in the United States, so they're citizens. And she and her husband, along with many in her neighborhood, now live under the threat of deportation at any moment. And there they are, Jim and this Mexican lady having this conversation, and he's sharing his story, she's sharing her story. And I'm listening to Jim as the story unfolds. And I woke up this morning and thought, oh my God, it's the gospel story. So I imagine Jim now showing up. And by the way, he's established a friendship with this Mexican lady. They talk now on a regular basis. And I could see them getting together once again. And she says to him, hey, pilot boy with no plane. And he says to her, hey, Mexican lady with no papers. And it turns out that Jim, prior to showing up at these meetings and getting to know this woman, was convinced that a wall is the way to go. And as he has learned her story, as he shared it with me, he's begun to question that approach. And he was all about build it long, build it high, build it deep. And now he's hearing from his friend, the Mexican lady, that if her husband and she are deported, their kids stay here and this family is broken. And he has some big questions about that. And he is now engaged with Nevadans for the common good. He doesn't have any brilliant ideas yet, but he's beginning to wonder about the wall thing, build it high, build it long, build it deep. And he's listening. He's listening. And apparently she's listening to him. I mean, they're friends now. And not only is Jim beginning to see a bigger picture through his friendship, but he has come out of that, and he came to us this weekend saying, maybe I can do this deacon thing. The Samaritan woman says to Jesus, hey, Jewish boy with no bucket. And Jesus says, hey, Samaritan lady with no husband. And what happens in this story, and this is what's held out for you and me. Not only do Jesus and the Samaritan woman hit it off and begin to build a friendship. Enemies, by the way, don't forget long-standing enemies. Don't forget that piece. Jewish guy, Samaritan lady, don't forget that piece either. Not only are they building a friendship, but before we even know what's happened in the story, they become partners. And they are now partners. By the time she goes back to her village and says to her family and her people, come and see. And, this couldn't be the Messiah, could it? Wink, wink. All right? And her family and friends are going, what? What's going on? And by the time they come back, and of course you can imagine her regaling them with stories, you got to meet this Jewish boy with no bucket. He's just a kick. and they all show up, and they all, Samaritans, enemies, begin to engage Jesus and he with them, lo and behold, an entire village become friends and partners. While Jesus' disciples are talking out of their heads, trying to figure out who he is, what he's about, and what he wants from them. Do you see the power of this story? You and I are invited to give up talking out of our heads and engage head to head. Don't just toss it, because it's kind of attached, isn't it? But we're invited to engage head to head and heart to heart, like Jesus and the Samaritan woman, and imagine ourselves as friends and partners. And it's why we're here. This is what the Eucharist, this is what our worship is all about. And one of the things that stops us from fully engaging, Jesus is our friend, Jesus is our partner, we're partners with Jesus, we're in this together, is that on some basic level, we've convinced ourselves we're not worthy. Right? And we've perhaps gotten that from, who knows, all kinds of sources, all kinds of people, all kinds of experiences. We've got, you know, years and years of moments and memories that tell us we're not worthy. And we get stuck in this shame-based place and can't seem to get past it. when just like the disciples, again, talking out of their heads, trying to figure it all out. So we get caught in this loop of trying to figure it all out. If we give ourselves permission to just drop the rock and stop catching ourselves in this loop, and please hear me on this. This happens all the time with me. All the time. I wake up in the middle of the morning, sometimes 2-3 o'clock in the morning, going, oh my God, I didn't do this. I didn't call this person. I didn't make this better. I didn't figure this out. I couldn't control that. And it's all shame-based garbage that tells me I'm unworthy, that I'm not able to do this, whatever this happens to be. So I get it. I live with this. And so far it hasn't gone. I'd love to stand here and tell you, oh yeah, the hands of Jesus have anointed me and I'm well. I don't have to mess with this no more. And I gotta break it to you, it hasn't happened yet. So I struggle, as do many or maybe all of us, but here's the ticket. You know, let the head run. Just let it run. It's going to run. It's going to do whatever it's going to do. And just pay attention to what's in front of us. And we may discover, as our heads are running, that Jesus has already appeared, either from without or within. I mean, Jesus might appear to us as a Samaritan lady, or better yet, a Mexican lady. And we may find ourselves entering into not only a friendship, but a partnership, in which the question or the concern about being unworthy can slowly erode and evaporate, where it is it'll keep coming, but it's no longer the defining factor, because we have friends. We have a partner, and not just Jesus, but look at who showed up today. All these folks who were partners. And there's more to be had. Oh my gosh, there's people out there we don't know. There's people out there that we think don't belong. I mean, on it goes. And we may discover, if we engage those folks, just like Jim did, that Jesus comes to us and our meaning comes to us, maybe even our vocation comes to us from Mexican ladies. You never know. So one day I come home, about 2 weeks ago, talking with my lovely, intelligent, talented wife. And we're talking. And I notice, because, you know, nothing gets by me, that on the coffee table is a book. Now, we no longer buy books in our house because we've run out of room for books. We had to combine two or more libraries and have given away tons, I mean tons and tons and tons of books just to fit them in the house. So Kindle is our friend, and now we get stuff on Kindle, library, you know, Amazon, whatever, and it's nice and contained and compact. And so the fact that this book is sitting on the coffee table and I'm going, hey, there's a book. And my lovely, intelligent, talented wife says, by gummies, there is. And we're talking, blah, blah, blah. And I noticed the book again because nothing gets by me. And I said, you know, this book, what's with the book? And she says, oh, that's for you. Now, I've been reading all kinds of stuff, amazing stuff. The book Hamilton, Ron Chernow. And then I read White Trash, the 400-year history of poverty in America. And I got to tell you, I've been getting angry, and I'm going down the rabbit hole because I'm noticing all the things that are wrong with our country and our culture. Arrgh! And she gets to listen to it on a regular basis. Ad nauseum. Arrgh! So here's this book sitting on the coffee table, and she tells me it's for me, and I just finished these other books, and I'm plenty angry, and also I grab this book, and I pick it up, and I start to read it, and go, whoa. It's called The Book of Joy, and it's a conversation between the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And these are two really funny guys. And I'm about 100 pages into the book, and I can only read like a page at a time if I'm lucky, because it's so dense. They're saying so much between the two of them. It's a two-week conversation between them. They're hanging out, and the author of this book is hanging out with them. And we get to the part where the Dalai Lama, it's talking about what is joy? And how does one live a life of joy? Pretty simple, but there's all kinds of pieces to the puzzle. And the Archbishop, Desmond Tutu, says, well, he says, what the Dalai Lama and I are offering is a way of handling your worries. Remember, the head, the unworthy, all the things we're not doing, saying, you know, fixing, controlling, whatever. The way of handling your worries is to think about others. You can think about others who are in a similar situation, or perhaps even a worse situation, but who have survived, even thrived. It does help quite a lot to see yourself as part of a greater whole. And then he goes on. Once again, says Archbishop Tutu, the path of joy is connection, and the path of sorrow is separation. When we see others as separate, they become a threat. Sound familiar? And when we see others as part of us, connected, interdependent, then there is no challenge we cannot face together. And I had to stop there. A Jewish boy with no bucket. A Samaritan lady with no husband. Hey, priest boy with no hair. Hey, fly boy with no plane. Hey, Mexican lady with no papers. We're partners. Take a moment.